Good morning and welcome to a special edition of Midday. I'm Gary Eichten, and today we're broadcasting live from the Maude Moon Weyerhaeuser studio here at Minnesota Public Radio. We've moved to the big studio because we've got a big program today. The DFL party is holding its precinct caucuses this weekend, and topping the agenda is the race for the U.S. Senate nomination here in Minnesota. There are six major candidates who are running for the U.S. Senate seat currently held by Republican Rod Grams. This weekend, the candidates officially begin the process of trying to gather enough support to win the party endorsement in June and the party nomination in September. Today, all six candidates will be joining us around our broadcast table to discuss the issues and explain to those of you here in the studio and those of you listening on the radio why they think they are the best DFLer to run against Senator Grams. Should be a great opportunity to find out more about each candidate and where they stand on the issue. So let's get started here. We've arranged the candidates more or less alphabetically around the table. Michael Cerisi is a Minneapolis attorney, best known for his work on Minnesota's lawsuit against the tobacco companies. Mr. Cerisi, thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon, Gary. Thank you for having me.
David Littlehog is a former U.S. attorney from Minnesota. He is a practicing Minneapolis attorney.
Hey, Littlehog. Gary. Thank you.
Steve Miles is a University of Minnesota physician from Minneapolis. Dr. Miles.
Join NPR.
Rebecca Yanish is a construction company executive from Minneapolis, perhaps best known as a former executive director of the Minneapolis Community Development Agency. Thanks for coming by today.
Delighted to be here, Gary.
Now, two of the candidates aren't with us at the start of the program here. They have been bogged down with the business at the state capitol. Both are state senators, Jerry Janosich from Chisholm and Steve Kelly from Hopkins, but they will be along just as soon as they can, as soon as Senate business permits. But let's get started. The format really pretty simple today. I'll ask one of the candidates a question, then the other candidates will be able to add their comments if they have anything to add. And hopefully during the course of the program, we'll touch on some issues that actually matter to those of you listening. Mr. Cerisi, since you're here, let me start with you. Barring some big surprise, the number of people who will actually show up for the precinct caucuses tomorrow is going to be pretty small, a relatively small fraction of DFLers and a mere sliver of the people who will be voting in November or who could vote in November. Will the endorsement of the folks who do show up, will their endorsement actually mean much of anything? Is this the best way we should pick a candidate in Minnesota?
Well, Gary, I'm reminded of the words of Yogi Berra. It's tough to make predictions, especially about the future. I believe that you have the potential to get many more people involved. Our campaign has attempted to reach out to people through the television ads that we've had, informing people of the caucuses or what are now called meetings. I know that the other campaigns of the other candidates here have done the same. We're trying to get people out. The DFL has to expand its base. In 1998, we had 17,000 people at caucuses and over 500,000 people voted in the primary election. We need to get a better and more broad and representative sample of people at these caucuses, or they do not hold the value that they should hold when you go to the general electorate. So I'm hopeful. I can't predict what will happen, but it depends on the weather and everything else. We hope we get a lot more people than we did in 1998.
Mm-hmm. You folks agree? David Littlehog?
Gary, we all want to see more people at the caucuses, but I'm seeking and will abide by the DFL endorsement because I think the caucuses do provide some value. They provide value in terms of building a grassroots organization to take on and beat Rod Grams, and that's especially important this year with an incumbent Republican senator and with the primary being so late on September 12th. So we're reaching out to grassroots DFL activists all over the state and building a tremendous grassroots organization. But we are also running a two-track campaign. You just can't court DFL activists. We need to reach out to a lot of people who've become disengaged from the DFL party, and especially reach out to young people who have not become engaged. Neither party, DFL nor Republican, has done a very good job of reaching out to young people and connecting with them on their concerns about the environment and diversity and education. And I'm just very proud that our campaign is doing that.
I love Minnesota.
Steve Miles.
Yeah, this is Steve Miles. And, you know, I love the caucus system, and I'll tell you why. First off, you know, unlike states which have primaries, which essentially are one-way conversations where people get bombarded with ads, a caucus is where the political conversation starts among the people who are most interested in the political conversation. And so it's not just the attendees, it's not just the activists, but it's also people who hold and help shape the broader conversation in their communities. I think they're great. The second thing that the caucuses do is they also increase the diversity of candidates who can get onto the ballot. If Minnesota shifted straight over to a primary system because of the low attendance at the caucuses, it would be $2 to $3 million to launch a primary campaign, and that would narrow the people who come out of the system. And that's why Minnesota has produced people like Humphrey, people like McCarthy, people like Paul Wellstone, because these people have been able to hold a broad conversation, which is necessary so that we can have the interests of people directly represented in the ballot. I think it's great. I'm totally enjoying the conversation leading up to the caucuses, and I hope we do well.
Mm-hmm. Rebecca Yanish?
Yes, this is Rebecca. My comment is, you know, first when we talk about discussions in democracy, I really want to compliment NPR. As I travel in greater Minnesota, so many people say, I heard you on public radio. It's wonderful to hear from the candidates and talk about the issues and get that message out. So thank you very much for your work in that effort. But I also want to commend the DFL, the party itself, for having the courage to say, look, things aren't working as well as we want them to work. Let's look at ways to change the systems. Can we do this on a weekend instead of a Tuesday night? Now, a number of people say, gee, I would have preferred a Tuesday night. But if a weekend helps draw more people into the process, I think that's great. I think also streamlining the system and shortening the process helps also, because we're all very busy in many parts of our lives. So I just want to say thank you, DFL, for this experiment in democracy, and really encourage people to show up on Saturday and Sunday at the caucuses.
Have you decided if you're going to abide by the endorsement, whoever gets endorsed in June?
Well, in respect, in full respect to the party, what I need to do is find out how our experiment will work. Who will come this weekend? Can we draw in more people? I fully respect also the work that my fellow candidates here at the table have done in reaching out to people for a longer period of time than I have. And if people have made commitments to other candidates, I respect those commitments. So I need to find out after this weekend, who are the delegates? Have commitments been made? Will I have an opportunity to tell my story?
Mr. Cerisi, any second thoughts about planning to go ahead to the primary no matter what happens with the endorsement?
Not at all. I said at the outset that I was going to do that. I'd ask Rebecca, let's assume that people are committed and you find that you don't have an opportunity to get the endorsement because you've not been in it. Are you going to abide by the endorsement, or are you going to the primary? Because I think people have a right to know. I've told folks that I'm going to the primary. I said that from the day I announced. I agree with Steve. When you look at the caucus, it's an opportunity to talk to people, to exchange ideas. But the fact is, when Hubert Humphrey and Eugene McCarthy ran, we had many fold more people attending the caucuses. It was more representative. We don't have that today. And someone who does get in late, as Rebecca did, and I did, it's much more difficult to get folks to not to listen to you, because they will listen, but they have made commitments. And I think on a statewide basis, the caucus system works fabulously well for local elections and the state legislature. But when you have statewide campaigns, maybe a middle road is better. Maybe what we should have is the convention endorsing three or four people, or giving a favorable or non-favorable to candidates, and let them go in the primary, so you have the best of both worlds. I don't know, but we have to find ways to get participatory democracy to its fullest extent here in Minnesota. That's what we need, and I think all the candidates feel that way.
Rebecca Yanish?
Yes. In response to your question, Mike, I'm going to work very, very hard to reach out to every delegate and find out whether commitments have been made or not. We've seen the polls in the last week, too, and know that probably half the voters in Minnesota haven't made up their minds yet. My grandfather, Leonard Driscoll, was a strong activist in the party. He actually supported Hubert Humphrey in the Chicago 68 Democratic Convention. So I was raised being taught the importance of grassroots organization and reach out and really talk to the people who make the commitment of getting involved. So in respect to those people who may be at the caucuses this weekend, you know, yes, please participate. I'd love to talk to you. Let's see where it's at. But if commitments have been made and I don't have an opportunity to have my voice heard, then I hope to be there on September 12th. My first choice is to be there as the DFL endorsed candidate.
So you will be in the primary.
Steve Miles?
This is Steve Miles. You know, I think that it is very important for, and Minnesotans want, a senator who will talk with them. They want to have a conversation with their senator. And this is the kind of thing that we saw, for example, in New Hampshire. People want to see the candidate. And so that's why when I started my campaign, what I did was I stopped my long-term commitments at work. I stopped applying for long-term grants. I stopped taking on long-term course assignments. And finally, I stopped taking on clinical work in order to have the conversation. Because I want to be the kind of candidate that people know I will be there to listen to them and not swoop in at the last minute and just bombard them with one-way conversations of ads and kind of bumper stickers and other approaches that just manipulate opinion. And so I'm happy to have made the commitment to the long-term conversation. I think that one thing that the precinct caucuses do is they separate out the candidates who are willing to say, I'm willing to take on a state of 4.5 million people and have conversations all over it to make this to show you what kind of senator I'll be.
David Littlehawk.
Yeah, we're following very closely, of course, what Michael Cerisi and Rebecca Yanish are saying on this, and I just want to point out what the danger is. We're up against an incumbent Republican senator in the extreme right wing of the Republican Party, and this guy's going to have an unlimited budget and will exceed it. And my worry, of course, is that if we fight through September 12, somebody's going to wake up in the morning of September 13 without very much money. Well, there may not be one candidate in that position, but wake up without money, having bruised the party and gone through the bad experience that we had in 1998. So my goal in this race is to get a nominee and unify behind the nominee as early as possible. And let's keep our fire on Rod Grams, because I think that's the way we win this election, and we build a great grassroots field organization going door to door, shoe leather, hard work, face-to-face contact. That's the way to beat Rod Grams.
You know, Dave,
Steve Miles.
This is Steve Miles. Dave, I understand this business about keeping the fire on Rod Grams, but you know what? November 7th, Rod Grams is going to be a footnote. And then the questions are going to be, who is this person and what is this person's agenda? What is this person going to do about the big problems, about health care, education, retirement, and so forth? And to my mind, saying that the objective here is simply to defeat Rod Grams creates a big mystery about what is November 7th. And I think that while we have to point out Rod Grams' record, we have to keep in mind that the real question is, what are Minnesotans going to know and say and think about on November 7th. That's how we should say who we are.
Let's move on to another question, okay? Mm-hmm. Senator Grams has said repeatedly that the proudest achievement of his first term in office was shepherding through the $500 per child tax credit. And he noted the other day on the Midday program, as a matter of fact, that it's been a significant benefit to Minnesotans, saving Minnesotans hundreds of millions of dollars. Do you folks support Senator Graham's effort in that area? David Littlehawk, why don't you begin, please?
Yes, I do. In fact, the day I announced, I was asked whether Rod Grams had done anything good in the Senate, and I specifically pointed to that $500 per child tax credit. Of course, though, success has 1,000 parents, and that credit was not Senator Graham's idea. I give him the compliment of working to help get it through, and because he was a freshman senator, he was identified by the Republican leadership as somebody who should help carry that. The bottom line, though, is that as we approach tax policy, we've got to approach it in such a way that, first of all, does not pose a real hazard to our country's fiscal stability, And where I do disagree with Senator Graham's is this idea of a $1 trillion tax cut over a period of 10 years. I don't think the federal government can predict much of anything past 1 year, much less a 10-year prediction. And I think his proposal in that regard will far outweigh any good that might have been done by that $500 per child tax credit, because he's really putting our economic health and our fiscal stability at risk.
Everybody agree? No. Rebecca?
Well, actually, I'd like to point out that, yes, the tax credit and have it, you know, targeted to the children in a family as qualification is good, but the problem is there is no income targeting here whatsoever. And the real benefit, especially when you start talking about other tax cuts and alternative minimum taxes, is the system distorts so that really the low-income and the moderate-income working families are actually penalized under some of the across-the-board tax cuts that the Republicans are talking about. So, yes, let's support our children, let's support our working families, but let's be a lot smarter about how we do it so the people most in need get the benefit.
Michael Cerisi?
Well, I think I'd like to follow up a little bit on what Rebecca said, because I think we're agreeing. Mm-hmm. The $500 tax credit didn't help the poorest of people in this country or in this state. So you do need to target tax credits in a much more focused fashion to help people move up the economic ladder. But I think you have to take a look at Mr. Graham's tax credit proposal together with what he's done in its entirety. He wants to dismantle the Social Security system, the most successful federal program we have seen in the last 40 years. And he does it based on a model that comes from Chile that was introduced for pensions under General Pinochet. Now, of course, when they introduced that pension program down there, they didn't include the military in it. The military stayed on their guaranteed pensions. And he does not, his program is fiscally, and I believe socially, irresponsible. So when we start talking about a $500 tax credit, let's take a look at it in terms of everything else he wants to do. I think his tax cut, David, what he's doing is endorsing George W. Bush's tax policy, which is a $750 billion tax cut over the next 10 years. Out of the non-Social Security surplus. Well, if you do that, you have no money for programs. And if the surplus does not materialize, then you have to ask Mr. Graham, what are you going to do then? Raise taxes? Or are you going to cut other programs? And if you're going to cut other programs, which programs? Head Start, Medicare, Social Security again, education? We need to reinvest. This election is about people's progress and about reinvesting in each other. We do some things in this country better together than we do individually, and that's been the history of this country, and that's going to be the overriding issue.
Steve Miles?
You know, the question was about kids. And let's take a look at what's happening while Mr. Graham's has been in office. We now have one-fifth of our kids living in poverty. We have the number of kids without health insurance going from about 8 million to more than 11 million. Mr. Graham's fought the Family Leave Act, by which assured that a mother could take her kid to the doctor without fear of being fired for simply being a good parent. He voted against aid to disabled kids, to cut the SSI program for disabled kids. He's voted against federal aid to rebuild crumbling schools. He has allowed the foster care system, of which I'm intimately familiar as a foster parent, to continue to crumble, so that we have disasters like that one in Michigan where a kid from a crack house goes and shoots a schoolmate. And if you take this $500 tax credit, nobody would fight against it, but the cost of raising a child is around $150,000. And in that context, $500 is useful to families, but is not nearly the cost of raising a kid. And furthermore, when you take it in context with the other tax cuts, for the average family under $60,000 a year, for every dollar of tax relief, including the $500 tax cut, people earning $700,000 a year got $1,200. This is a decoy operation.
Actually, I think the question was, would we have voted for or against the $500 per child tax credit? My answer is yes. I guess I'm not clear where the other candidates are on this, whether it's a yes answer or a no answer. And okay. I think what drove people nuts in 1998 in the gubernatorial election is that people didn't answer questions.
All right, let's go around the table.
I'd be glad to answer that.
Michael Cerisi?
You can't answer some questions with just sound bites. I mean, that's what some people want to do, but these issues are much more complex. Are people in favor of a $500 tax credit for children? I think everybody at this table is. But what does that mean in the context of the entire bill? What else should be done? I think that's what Rebecca was addressing. I understand that's what Steve was addressing, and that's what I'm addressing. That's what Democrats are about. We are about reinvesting in people, and we have to take a look at programs that have the best chance to move people up the economic ladder. Education is the key to that. I think everybody here at this table agrees with it. That's where we differ from Senator Graham's. We need to get good educational programs in place. We need to have good schools. We need to have the facilities where they can be educated. We need to make sure they have books. If you go around greater Minnesota, you're finding that some of these things are not being done. That's what we're about, and that's what we ought to be talking about. And David, when you go back to the previous question, let me tell you what I'm going to do between now and the primary. I'm going to be talking about the difference between Democrats and Mr. Graham's. That's what I'm going to be doing. And if that differentiates me from you or whoever else, if I don't get the endorsement, whoever comes out of the party convention, that's fine. But it is going to differentiate me from Mr. Graham's.
But just to clarify, everybody would at the table here would have voted yes on the $500 per child tax credit.
I think it's
Steve Miles.
Steve Miles. Of course, I would vote for tax credits for people raising kids, but this is a bait and switch. It's not enough. It goes. We have to do it and have health insurance for kids. We have to do it and have decent schools for kids. And it is unjust to do this while we're putting in these huge tax cuts for the very wealthy. The people who need the help are the parents. And $500 in the context of a bill, which was basically a giant income transfer from working everyday working Americans to the very wealthy, is the wrong kind of policy. So I would not have voted for the total bill, but I will be on there every day making sure that parents have enough money to raise their kids, have decent schools for their kids, have ways of taking care of disabled or sick kids, and have the money to raise their kids.
So let's see. So you would have voted against it?
I would vote to make sure. Well, FDR said, no nation is so rich that it can afford to waste its human resources. And Graham's is wasting human resources by the pattern here. I would vote for tax credits for raising kids, but 500 is too low.
Okay. And Michael Cerisi, you said you would. Rebecca Yanish?
I'd vote for the tax credit, but in the process, I would have fought very hard to make sure it was more targeted.
And that's the key. I mean, you just
this is Michael Cerisi.
You ask someone whether they would vote for it up or down, just straight up or down, everybody at this table would vote for it if that's all you had. The issue is who's going to be the most effective advocate for this state on the floor of the Senate and in the Senate office buildings and going beyond that. What gets to the Senate floor is a product of what's gone on before, how effective you are as a leader in building coalitions and getting other senators to move. That's what's important. So I think a straight up or down, yes or no, if that's all you could get, everybody vote yes, but I think everybody would try to do much better than that. That's what we're talking about. That's the difference between us and Mr. Graham's.
If you're just joining us, this is a special edition of Midday here on Minnesota Public Radio. Today we're broadcasting from Minnesota Public Radio's Maude Moon Weyerhaeuser studio in St. Paul. All six of the major candidates seeking the DFL party's nomination for the U.S. Senate are coming by today to talk about the issues in this year's Senate campaign. This weekend, of course, the DFL is holding its precinct caucuses at which these candidates will begin the official process of trying to win the party's endorsement and then the party's nomination. Candidates include Rebecca Yanish, former director of the Minneapolis Community Development Agency, University of Minnesota Dr. Steve Miles, former U.S. Attorney David Littlehaug, trial attorney Michael Cerisi. State Senators Steve Kelly and Jerry Janicek will be joining us just as soon as Senate business will allow. If you can't stay tuned, by the way, all the way to 1 o'clock this afternoon, we will be rebroadcasting this program starting at 9 o'clock tonight here on Minnesota Public Radio, the full two-hour rebroadcast. Also, check it out on our website, mpr.org, and you can hear the full debate. Let's move along here. Steve Miles, oil prices have reached the highest peacetime level since 1981. Apparently, even higher prices are on the way. What, if anything, ought to be done about that?
Well, these oil prices, the problem is the rate of increase of these oil prices. And these oil prices are way too high, and the shift has been way too high, and they're going to be going up to $1.80. Now, one way to go after this is to say, well, we have made aid to OPEC, aid to Kuwait, and aid to Mexico, and we have to punish them for doing this. On the other hand, we also need corn ethanol. We need soy ethanol. We should never have embarked on a wholesale strategy of building SUVs for everybody. And we need to exercise better conservation and proceed with the development of hybrid vehicles or gas electrical vehicles. We should never have allowed our strategic reserves of gasoline to get so low that we were vulnerable to this kind of pressure. And furthermore, though our gas prices are much, much lower than Europe, we should consider ways of using our tax policy to address these price increases for people in adversely affected industries like farming and trucking, and particularly in rural areas. But ultimately, what we are going to have to face here is the fact that we have a society that is too energy dependent and is producing too many greenhouse gases. That's got to be addressed. But we should never have let ourselves become this vulnerable to foreign action.
Rebecca Yanish?
Well, as someone who just filled up my gas tank three times in the last 24 hours.
You got to see what my ambulance costs.
Speaking of gas guzzlers.
Well, doctor, you should be more environmentally sensitive and not drive that ambulance around.
I make a fundraising call before I drive to Wilmer.
Well, I'm driving a very fuel-efficient car, but still putting on a lot of miles, and so I certainly am very aware of the price of gas right now. But as I look at it, as senator, what I'd really like to be emphasizing is choices, certainly light rail transit, other choices in moving people through our communities. That really adds to the quality of life everywhere in the state of Minnesota. And also, as someone who grew up in the Red River Valley, I certainly come from an area where the wind never stops blowing. So why can't we do more with the wind-generated energy, you know, and looking at other alternatives? Also, from my farm background, I am certainly sympathetic to looking at how we can transfer our agricultural products and use those instead of being held hostage by OPEC. So I certainly also support ethanol processing.
David Littlehog?
Well, I approach this from a little different standpoint. Essentially, what we're dealing with here are two monopolies. We're dealing with OPEC, and the key actors in OPEC have been Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, who we went to war for a few years ago. And then, of course, outside of OPEC, Mexico, who we bailed out of their peso crisis a few years ago. I think both Congress and the administration have been asleep at the switch in terms of the diplomatic efforts required to prevent this drastic reduction of production, and that has caused this enormous increase in prices. But the second essential monopoly we're dealing with is big oil. Now, why has there hardly been a peep out of Washington in the last few months when Exxon and Mobil merged, the world's largest oil company merging with the world's third largest oil company? And this is happening all over the world, and it's not just happening in oil, it's happening in agriculture and telecommunications and other segments of the energy business. The studies show that big oil has such economic power that when the world price of oil goes up, they sock it to you at the station right away. But when it goes down, they reduce the prices very, very slowly. That's the economic power of big oil. We need to enforce our antitrust laws, and I think we need a little Teddy Roosevelt trust busting these days.
Michael Cerisi?
Well, and I think we ought to debate this, because I think what David's answer shows a little bit about sloganeering in campaigns. If we're going to take those type of drastic measures, what happens to the other countries with regard to our computer chips? We're in an interrelated global economy right now. Things we can do is we have to give tax incentives to develop alternative sources of energy. We absolutely need to do that. The average mile per gallon of gasoline, the federal requirements should apply to SUVs. We all recall that when we put in seatbelts, Lee Iacocca was screaming bloody murder at Chrysler, but after they found out that they were so very effective, remember they said they couldn't get in, it was too costly, all these things, but when they got in, all of a sudden he was claiming credit for putting out the safest cars that you've ever seen. We need to get to the companies and say they're going to have to develop cars that are more fuel efficient. Americans like SUVs. They're going to continue to buy them. That's just a fact. So now we have to develop alternative sources of energy, give tax credits, use your tax policy to do that, and get requirements that they move up the average per mile gallon on SUV vehicles. I think that's one. And thirdly, use the diplomatic initiatives, the old jawbone that we're able to do with the countries who are producing petroleum.
In the short run, there's been some talk perhaps about lowering the federal gas tax to help smooth prices out a little bit. Would anybody at this table support that idea?
I would lower the federal diesel fuel tax, because the independent truckers who are just getting beat over the head are going out of business because of this latest increase in fuel prices. And let's remember, in the electronic economy, a lot of the goods that are ordered over the internet are going to be delivered by trucks. And so we've got a very strong interest, I think, in making sure that there's competition in the trucking industry and that independent truckers don't get knocked out of business.
Okay. Go ahead, Rebecca.
Well, I was just going to say that actually I wouldn't support lowering the gas tax, because I think when you compare our state and our nation to other industrialized nations, our gas tax is actually quite low. And I do think that we need to dedicate those revenues to maintaining our road systems and also providing other alternative transportation systems.
This is Mike Cerisi. I agree with Rebecca on that. If you were going to lower the excise tax, then you'd have to convince me that we would not be impairing the ability to maintain the transportation system, particularly in the rural areas. So if you're going to lower that tax, then I want to make sure that there's other revenues that would go into transportation to maintain that transportation system.
Steve Miles?
I can't recall a single article in any of the newspapers complaining that gas prices were too low when they dropped down to about 90 cents about a year ago. And so I guess the question would be, are we willing to use the tax code that way to maintain a certain cost of gas? I think the question is, why don't we have a mass transit system in the United States? Why don't we have a mass transit system in Minnesota that's worthy of this type of state? Rail system to St. Cloud with why don't we have rail here in the cities? And, you know, what we've done is we've made ourselves vulnerable to this type of price attack by our attacks on all the different alternatives for managing this kind of thing, including Graham's attack on corn ethanol.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Steve, they have...
This is Mike Cerisi.
They have... And we had to take a look at this structurally. In Europe, they have mass transportation systems, and they have a lot higher gas prices.
Yep.
The fact is, to put in the corridor to St. Cloud is going to cost hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars. We're seeing what is it going to cost to go out to the airport, $540 million, I think. Yes, we have to develop mass transit, but we have to encourage people in some way to use that mass transit. And it is part of the... urbanization that we're seeing and the growth. That is why I've said we need rural revitalization, because all of this is integrated, and that's the type of policy that I think we have to look at.
Dave Littlehawk?
Well, you know, I support alternative energy. I'm a big fan of wind power. You go out to Ruthin and look at those windmills. Boy, that's the wave of the future for us, because we're the Saudi Arabia of wind. But we have to continue that, and it's down the road. There are real people hurting right now. Independent truckers, talked to one the other day named Bob Franklin. He's ready to go out of business because of this massive increase in diesel fuel. Agriculture, boy, we got farmers who are getting historically low prices, and when their cost goes up by 50% over 1 year, we're going to be knocking family farmers off the land. Soccer moms, commuters, everybody's feeling the pain. So, yeah, I think we need some short-term solutions, and I think it starts at the top with the president being a lot tougher and really weighing in and delivering the message to OPEC. You've got to change this on March 27 in Vienna.
But even, you know, Steve Miles
here.
Even if we changed OPEC's production today, we wouldn't see it at the pump for 3 to 4 months. You know, for farmers, this is a crisis on top of a crisis, and it would seem to me that the way to manage that crisis is to incorporate a gas price adjuster into the farm price supports for family farms and family corporate
farms. Whatever it is, we've got to help now.
But this isn't helped by just kind of saying, well, we should go and jawbone Mexico. We've got so much else to do.
Let's move on. Rebecca Yanish, one of the knottier problems facing members of Congress right now is what to do about China, trade with China. And apparently there's a growing opposition in Congress to granting China what's now called normal trading status. If you were in the Senate right now, how would you vote on that? You think China should be granted normal trading relations and thus kind of clear the way for their entry into the World Trade Organization?
My approach would actually to be handling in a way where we can revisit this on a continuing basis. I think granting the normalized trade relationship right now is very troublesome. I agree that there needs to be a process to open trade with China, but just opening the book right now without having any recourse in the future, to me, is very difficult. I look at the issues here, and I believe over the last, at least the last decade, every agreement we've had with China on issues of human rights, labor standards, or environment, every time we've tried to reach those agreements, they've been violated. And I'm concerned about what hook will we have in the future if we can't get consensus on these issues.
Everybody agree with that?
The answer to your question is no. I would vote against China being granted permanent most favored nation status. They should not be rewarded at a time when they are using child labor, when they're using slave labor. If you try to organize a union there, you get locked up. If you try to practice your religion there, you get locked up. And now they're embarked on a campaign to intimidate Taiwan. And this is not the kind of message we want to be sending either to China or to the world with regards to human rights at this point. Yes, there are a lot of multinational corporations very much at the table at the World Trade Organization and in the halls of Congress who are pressing very hard for this. But for us to lose our leverage on a year-by-year basis over China, it's the wrong time for that, no question about it.
Michael Cerisi?
Well, let me take a little different approach, I think. And I don't want to point to corporations or to these or that. Let's take a look at the overall policy from a long-term standpoint. I think we would all agree one thing we don't want to do is isolate China. Trade is good. What I call informed trade is even better. We need to put on the table in negotiations the issues of labor laws, environmental laws, food safety, human rights. China has signed but not ratified certain human rights covenants from the United Nations. They should be made to ratify them. You have to have this type of linkage, I believe, so that we can move toward normal trade relations with China. If you have that, then I would vote for normal trade relations with China, and I've said that. If we isolate them, we run the risk of bringing us up to the brink of a more severe problem with regard to Taiwan. But we also need to address, I think, the issue of Tibet in terms of the discussions with China. So we need a more informed bilateral treaty negotiation with them, taking into account these issues, and they have to be involved in the treaty. They can't be side agreements because you then do not have enforceable agreements.
Steve Miles, you have a comment?
Steve Miles. First off, we have a huge trading relationship with China. It's called a trade deficit, but it's absolutely enormous. And frankly, I oppose granting permanent normal trading status to China. But I think that the issue here is not simply their unwillingness to do various things, but is also our unwillingness, and particularly Mr. Graham's unwillingness, to work to have us create the types of agreements which would underline fair trade. For example, the United States has not ratified the Conventions on the Rights of Children, which pertain to preventing international child labor. We have not ratified the Convention on the Rights of Women, which pertain to the rights of women to be educated, to have full job opportunities, and to organize. We have not ratified an agreement on greenhouse gases, which pertain to the environmental subsidies in international trade. And furthermore, we don't even enforce the free trade agreements or fair trade agreements that we have. For example, when Brazil and South Korea were sending cheap subsidized steel to the United States, when we were having our own taconite plants closed up on the North Shore, Mr. Grams, the architect of free trade, even though free trade was being violated, votes to not enforce the agreement on banning cheap steel, but also to not help our steel industry, which is basically under assault. And I think we've got a lot to do on our side of the fence, too, instead of simply saying that the burden here is all on China. We need to build a larger structure for fair trade before we can have China come in.
Michael Cerisi, shifting gears here, President Clinton and others suggest that gun manufacturers should be required to provide trigger locks with all the guns that they make. Is that a good idea, number one? And then number two, what about George W. Bush's criticism that legislation like that's all fine and good, but it all, if they're going to work, it depends upon people actually using the trigger locks. And short of that, what you've got is basically empty feel-good legislation.
Well, that's exactly the approach that was taken, to go back to an issue I already raised, with seatbelts. People wouldn't use them. They were put in. They become mandatory. People have used them. Lives have been saved. Injuries have been reduced. It's been a good thing. You know, one of the arguments against trigger locks and a waiting period with regard to gun shows to provide gun safety is that it's a slippery slope, and the next thing that's going to happen is we're going to take away guns. Well, I have a family of hunters. They don't need assault weapons. They don't need armor-piercing bullets. They don't need Saturday night specials. Most hunters are in agreement with that. What we need is a rational approach to this issue so that we start saving our children. We are losing all kinds of children on a daily basis to this. And if people are afraid of that, let's say this. Let's have a sunset provision. Let's put these provisions into place. Keep them in for 5 or 6 years. See what happens. If these types of deaths go down, if the gun violence goes down, and that's a factor, then let's keep them. You know, we need to take a rational approach to this and stop killing kids. You know, I don't hear of drive-by lynchings. We do hear of drive-by shootings. And I think it's a question of a rational approach to this that does not drive apart the sportsmen and sportswomen from others in this country who believe this is a thing whose time has come, and it is.
Okay. Just a quick follow-up here. Just new guns, or would you make that retroactive so everybody who has a gun needs to go buy one of these trigger locks?
I would make it for new guns only. I don't think it's enforceable for old guns.
David Littlehawk?
Yeah, Gary, this is something I feel very, very strongly about as the former chief prosecutor for Minnesota who's seen what gun crime can do. As somebody who's a hunter, I grew up in South Dakota, and I just love to go hunt pheasant with my dad. And finally, as the father of an 8-year-old child, I have a gun in my household. It has a trigger lock on it, and in fact, it's right here on my key ring. And it's in a locked gun case. I feel very, very strongly that's part of the solution, and that Senator Grams was absolutely irresponsible in being one of only 20 senators to vote against the bill that would require when you buy a handgun, you buy a trigger lock. Even the National Rifle Association didn't oppose that. Now, is that going to prevent all the time children getting their hands on guns? No. Because besides locking up guns, you have to have things called responsible parents who educate children about the hazards of guns if we're going to have firearms, hunting, and shooting sports in our society. And I can't guarantee that as United States Senator, but I will stand up against the National Rifle Association and work very hard for trigger locks and also for the education programs that need to go with them. Now, I really commend Mayor Sharon Sales Belton and Mayor Norm Coleman and the National Shooting Sports Federation for supplying 10,000 trigger locks. That was just announced yesterday. We need to be doing more things like that.
Steve Miles,
you know, and hunting and target shooting are part of Minnesota life. But I'll tell you, here's my exposure. I'm a doctor. I come from a hunting family. But there's an initial we use in the hospital, GSW, gunshot wound. And I don't know how many hundreds of times I've written GSW on medical charts. So I know what GSW victims look like. And we write that because it's something that when we have a condition we see a lot of, that's why we use initials. And that's a terrible thing. We need to prevent people who have a history of violent crime from gaining access to or owning weapons. I support having one side of every gun transaction go through a licensed dealer. Trigger locks will prevent injuries in two ways. First, they'll prevent accidents. And secondly, once we get enough trigger locks out there, they will empower attorneys like Mr. Cerisi to go after people who don't use them. And I think that's a good thing, too. And so I support the use of the widespread dissemination of trigger locks as a way to create a new standard for what gun safety has to be and what the responsibility of parents are to both their own children and to their neighbor kids. I also support the ban on assault rifles, and I also believe that we're going to have to do something about short barrel cheap weapons, sometimes called Saturday night specials.
Rebecca Yanis, did you have a comment?
Yes, on the trigger lock issue, I totally agree it should be on every new weapon sold. And I also agree, too, that my former boss, Sharon Sales Belton, and Norm Coleman, together have come up with a great initiative to disseminate and, you know, provide on a free basis access to these gun locks so that existing weapons are more safe in our homes. I think of children in school and home, you know, they should not be worried when they go to school that there will be, you know, gunfire. I mean, that is such a basic principle. Our children should go to school without worrying about gunfire. And to me, the gun locks are a step in the right direction there. I do disagree, however, with Mike when he talks about a sunset provision. You know, I've seen too many areas in public policy where you have a sunset and no one takes it real seriously. And this is something everyone must take seriously to be able to enforce it appropriately.
David Lillehug, what's the best way to improve our health care system? If you could wave a wand, obviously I suppose you have several ideas, but start with one.
Well, one idea, and it's a very simple one, is extend Medicare to prescription medication. As I go around the state, even with the state prescription drug program that was passed last year, there's still many seniors that are not signed up and then in a very real way need to make decisions at the end of the month. Do I buy my prescription medication or do I eat? And things are a lot worse in other areas of the country. I was talking to a woman the other day in Isani County, and she told me that she takes 7 prescriptions a day. Her husband takes 11. And this is the trend in medical care. There's no question about it. We've got to extend Medicare to prescription medication. It's a huge hole in that program that has been so important to the health care of so many seniors. And I've got a heck of a lot of other ideas, but you asked for one, and that's one.
Just a quick follow-up on that. Would you extend that benefit to everybody, or would you means test it so that lower-income people would qualify, but perhaps not higher-income people?
I would extend it to everybody. I think one of the strengths of Medicare and one of the reasons why it has such support around the country is that it is a program where people have a right to participate in it and a right to receive the benefits. That doesn't mean everybody has to pay the same or that it has to be financed by everyone on the same equal basis. But I would put that in place in the same way we have Medicare right now, which is that everybody has a right to participate. Everybody who qualifies by reason of age, that is.
Okay. Everybody agree? Rebecca Yanish?
Well, my magic wand would tap the 11 million children in the United States that are uninsured. And to me, setting that as a top priority ensures longer-term health in terms of their adult lives and preventative costs in the future. I just think it's an absolute disgrace that as a civilized nation, as an industrialized nation, we can't figure out how to get that done. I look at smaller countries like Costa Rica. They set the priority. Everyone under 18 has access to free health care. And I think that's a priority we need to set also.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Dr. Steve Miles, you know, Rebecca, I disagree with you because I think that if a child's parent is sick, and you've often talked about you being hospitalized while you had a baby, after you had a baby, I think then the kid is injured as well. If the child's parent is having epilepsy, then the child is injured as well. We are the only industrialized nation that does not have insurance for everybody in our nation, and for that wreckage we pay a third more per person than any other country. In addition to that, we are in a changing economy, and because we have this bizarre policy where people are tied, their health care is tied to their jobs, we've got 50% of our population in a changing economy who are locked into their jobs and can't move to new jobs. That is a productivity loss. Everybody, seniors, adults and kids has to have comprehensive health care that includes drugs, mental health care, physical health care, from a physician of their choice that's affordable. And a little add-on is quite different from that. And Dave, you know, you got last week you uttered the magic words, bumper sticker politics again for single payer system. You picked up a COACT endorsement. I respect the single payer people. There are three different kinds of single payer plans. There are three different kinds of multi-payer plans. I challenge you to define the difference, but I also challenge you to offer a vision for larger health care.
Well, Steve, I would challenge you then to tell us exactly
how. This
is David Littlehaug. Steve, I would challenge you to tell us exactly how you're going to provide universal access, because we've heard you for a year talk about that, and we haven't seen any specifics. Are you in favor of? I think at one time you said you were in favor of what they have in the Netherlands. Is that right?
Okay, very briefly, because Michael Cerisi and Rebecca Yanish have comments too. Steve Miles?
No one senator is going to be able to dictate the final outcome of the U.S. healthcare system. But the question is, what candidate is most able to participate knowledgeably in that discussion? I was on Clinton's discussion. I was in the charge of the group that brought through Minnesota Care. There is no other candidate in this race or in any other state race that has my background on health care reform. I will make participating in this debate a daily priority, and I will tell you that I have more expertise on this question than anybody else at this table, even though I won't be able to dictate the final solution.
Michael Cerisi?
Well, I've always, during the course of my career, been interested in self-avowed experts who are the best at the table. I've met a lot of them during the course of my career, and I've probably dealt in more expert areas, Doctor, than you have during the course of your career. There is no magic wand, number one. And anybody here who says there's a magic wand is simply not telling the truth to Minnesotans and to others who are listening to this broadcast. I have convened some of the best minds in this state to inform me on this issue. They have all told me that. What I do know is this. We have the best acute care in the world, but it's very, very expensive. We have very poor preventive care, very poor care of chronic disease. We have to start competing on quality. That's what everybody says. Where do we start? I agree with Rebecca. I believe we start with the children. I think we also start in helping small businesses who employ 75% of the people in this country. They are unable, in many instances, to provide health care. We have to have a tax policy that enables them to provide health care, and it's got to be portable when they move from job to job. We spend $45 billion a year in emergency room care, $45 billion a year, and much of it is preventive care. Emergency rooms are the most expensive place. So let's start competing on quality and start looking at all these issues as to how we start getting people into the system.
Rebecca Yanish?
Yes, and quickly, and thanks, Mike, for your comment, too. Getting back, Steve, I agree. I'd love to have every parent covered, but I think we need to set priorities and be strategic about how we do this. 1992 presidential elections, there was an incredible debate about health care coverage. We've had 108 months of economic prosperity. We've talked about the political will being there. Nothing's happened. Let's at least start with the children.
Got 1 minute left. Quick comment.
Yeah, I've always been in favor of working on this issue in a deliberative manner. But to say there's no magic wand is simply to ignore the fact that this health care system is a political disaster. It's not a natural disaster like Hurricane Bertha or something. And this, we need to work on this at the fundamental level rather than simply saying there's no magic wand. In fact, there are 25 magic wands at least, and that we need to just find the 26th and wave it.
All right. We'll leave it there for now. We're going to take a short break here for news.